Excellent. Good morning, gentlemen, and welcome. I know you're old hands at using remote technology now.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I know. What joy. So as you've been instructed many times, if at any point there are any technical issues and you can't hear one of us or each other, let us know and we will let you know likewise. Otherwise, we will get going. 15 minutes for the appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes to the appellant for rebuttal. And we are still posting audio of the arguments online after the close of arguments. And so please introduce yourself first when you start. And if you're ready to proceed, I'm going to ask the marshal to call the court to order and call your case.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Bradfold, and Judge Sluter, the Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding. Calling case 821-1011, Katie Lynn Spooner on behalf of the minor children versus Jesse Dean Morton.
All right, and go ahead and proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bo McGraw. I represent the appellant, Jesse Warden, in this appeal. This is a case that stems from the district court, whereby a petition was brought on the behalf of two minor children, one 12 years old and one 7 years old, by the mother, Ms. Spooner, seeking an order of protection on behalf of the children. She alleged in her petition that the children were subjected to domestic violence in violation of Minnesota Statute 518B.01. In the petition, she raised three dates of specific allegations, one on January 24, 2021, another on April 25, 2021, and the last one on July 5, 2021. This matter was set for hearing and trial on July 15, 2021, and it occurred on that day. At the conclusion of the trial, the court determined that my client did in fact commit domestic violence in violation of Minnesota Statute 518B.01 and issued a 2-year order of protection. Oddly, the court then did not restrict my client's ability to spend time with the children. We'll revisit that as we go this morning. I want to start with a baseline just by providing the court with the specific language. I know the court's aware of it as it relates to 518B, but it helps me organize my argument if I just make a good record of it. To establish that Mr. Warden committed domestic violence as it relates to the children, the court has to find that physical harm, bodily injury, or assault occurred, or the court has to find that the children were in fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. So let's talk about the evidence that the court had before it to review whether or not the statutory obligations were met. The first allegations, as it relates to the January 24, 2021 incident, appears to have been dismissed by the court, as the court in its findings did not make reference to that issue. And the court shouldn't have. It was all impermissible hearsay. And the court didn't seem to go into that at all in its findings. The court did, however, determine that the statute was met by analyzing two incidents. And I'm going to do this chronologically. One was April 25, 2021, whereby the court received evidence. And the evidence was this, essentially, that at some point, the party's older child, Addison, had contacted mom via FaceTime. And I want the court, as we analyze these factual components to the case, to understand, which I think you can take judicial notice of, this has been protracted, ongoing parenting and custody litigation in and out of Hennepin County. These children have been involved in the court process from a very young age. These parties are very familiar with the court process. So we have an April 25 incident. The allegation is this, that at some point, Addison, the oldest child, breaks away, FaceTimes her mother. The allegation is that my client comes up from behind her and stretches her arms. That was the evidence we heard. We didn't hear grabbing. We didn't hear pushing. We certainly didn't hear striking. We heard a grabbing of the arms. We then hear next that a phone drops. The phone sits there. And that's the evidence. That's what the court heard by way of evidence. So let's analyze that incident if we can, because in that piece, now at the trial, the mom testified, the dad testified, no children testified. This other witness that is referenced throughout the petition, this Rochelle, she's not called to testify, despite the petitioner, the respondent in this case, but the petitioner relative to the petition had a lawyer. Lawyers well understood that witnesses could have been subpoenaed. The children could have been subpoenaed to testify or brought forward. Now, we take great pains to avoid that for very, very good reason. But this Rochelle certainly could have been compelled to testify. No subpoena. So here's what we have. We've got testimony of arms stretched out. We have a phone dropping. Let's analyze the statute, because that's what we're here to do. Physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. No. And the court doesn't find that that's what occurred there.
Mr. McGraw, I apologize for interrupting you, and I want to let you go ahead, but I just want to make
sure. Please do.
So you've raised, the way I read your brief, you've raised two issues on appeal, and one has to do with the admissibility of the hearsay evidence, and the second is more focused on overall sufficiency. I'm hearing your argument now to be starting mostly on sufficiency. Are you going to like keep those two issues together, or are you going to argue both of them? Or I guess I'm a little confused about your approach.
I think I'm misunderstanding. I'm trying to do it chronologically. And I think the sufficiency, I think I can do it together. And I think that's the best use of this 15 minutes. But the first issue, the first alleged incident, April 25, my argument's really sufficiency as it relates to that. When we get to the next incident that the court relied upon, July 5, I think there's a lot of the hearsay components that will find their way into that. So if you just bear with me for 1 minute, I want to analyze the April 25. Direct me however you want. This is your time. I'm here to try to help you analyze the issues. But the evidence was that there was a stretching and a phone drop on April 25. So if we look at the statute, physical harm, no. Bodily injury, no. Or assault. We know that there wasn't any descriptive testimony about bruising, bleeding, nothing like
but
that.
You don't, I mean, it technically fits the definition of assault, correct? Which is any physical contact. I mean, explain to me why it doesn't meet that definition, because you don't have to have bruises for an assault claim, or right. Is that not right?
No, I agree with you. You don't have to have bruising. I'm just, that testimony wasn't a part of the case. And the court didn't find that there was physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. The court found on that issue that there was fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And what I'm suggesting to the court by way of a sufficiency of evidence argument would be that that evidence wasn't developed. We didn't have anybody that provided testimony that that Addison said, I'm fearful that I was going to be assaulted.
So I read father's testimony as describing the older daughter as freaking out during this April incident and acknowledging that both children were scared. Am I reading father's testimony wrong?
No, you're reading it correctly, but freaking out, not as relates to dad's conduct. I think the overall story of the events that occurred that day is that there was conflict between dad and Rochelle, and the children had some anxiety and some fear associated with that part of the interaction. I didn't read the evidence
that would be father's perception, and I appreciate that, and he's entitled to testify to it, but that's not how we analyze sufficiency of the evidence to support the district court's finding that the children were in fear.
But they can be scared and they can be fear, but they've got to be in fear of imminent physical harm or bodily injury or be assaulted, and that means the actions of the aggressor, who in this case it's alleged that it's my client, would have had to have been directing his actions towards the children. The record is devoid of that analysis.
So counsel, that's a novel argument in a family situation of violence and interaction, that because father is directing his conduct toward his, I think, fiance, that somehow means the girls shouldn't be afraid for their own personal safety. Now, it's an inference that the district court could have rejected. The judge could have said, I'm not going to draw that inference based on everything I have learned, all the evidence. But here it appears that the judge did draw the inference that the children were afraid based on father's conduct. And it's that conduct can certainly include his conduct toward his fiance. Tell me where I'm wrong legally. I need to understand your argument better than I am, or perhaps you want to go on to the hearsay issue.
Yeah, so my on that issue is that the burden rests with the petitioner, and she had the ability to elicit testimony that would have got after whether or not the conduct, the alleged conduct of my client, allowed the children to be fearful of imminent physical harm, bodily or injury. And it could have been something so simple as had the children testify. Did you think that you were going to be assaulted or harmed physically? Now, we take great pains to avoid that. The other individual that was allegedly there, this Rochelle, she could have provided testimony in that regard. Mom could have testified that the children told her, and there could have been objection, but this court let a lot in, that they were scared that they were going to be physically harmed. We just have this whole...
So, counsel, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you again. So can you help me with some case law that says that we will ascertain sufficiency of the evidence based on evidence that could have been offered and wasn't offered? I mean, we look at the evidence that was offered and allow the district court, in this case with a bench trial, to take reasonable inferences based on that evidence. Do you want to talk about sufficiency, or should we move on and talk about hearsay?
We're going to talk about hearsay a little bit, Your Honor. Okay. And I think hearsay, that the best part of the hearsay evidence, first of all, on the April 25, 2021 incident, and on the July 5, 2021 incident, specifically the July 5, 2021 incident, it's an allegation that the children called their mother and said that dad was acting weird, that dad was acting aggressive, and then at some point, dad punched a hole in the wall. Dad, unrepresented by counsel, made an objection. He said it was hearsay. He said it was speculative. Counsel then said, let me make an offer of proof. The record shows that he cited Rule 401 on the record as his belief that his client has the ability to provide testimony as it relates to her discussions with the child on that day. And then on his appeal, he cites Rule 701. It's classic hearsay. What you had in this case was you had a mother who said that the child told me this. It's classic hearsay. I don't know what way around it there could be. Counsel said it's opinion-related testimony that she's providing relative to that incident, but the court doesn't make any record. The only record whereby my client's objection is addressed is on page 15 of the transcript, where counsel is asked to make his offer of proof. He says 401. Then my client kind of inarticulately says why he's challenging the testimony. And then we get into a discussion about whether or not he has a lawyer. And then the court, without making specific findings, how the testimony comes in, either through evidence, rule of evidence 401, which I don't know how it can be, because that's just the general relevancy portion of a rule.
Yeah, let's just skip over this 401, 701 dichotomy. It doesn't seem relevant to the hearsay issue you're trying to raise on appeal. I'm watching the clock, and I want to make sure I ask you this question. So when I read the transcript of this case, I saw a very general objection about hearsay and this discussion that you're mentioning about offer proof. When it came time for the mother to actually testify, and she offered the statements from her children, there was no objection that I saw by fathers. So aren't we under plain error review on this?
We are, you're correct.
Okay, you're correct. It is plain error review? Okay, thank you.
It is. You're 100% correct. And I would ask you, as you analyze that issue, that you would read the transcript as a whole, and that my client did make objection that was appropriate at a time in the transcript. And then he was kind of directed by the court, and I'm not saying the court did it wrong here, but he was directed by the court to say, these are arguments that you're going to make when you provide testimony at some point in these proceedings. And so I think he held all his powder and said, I'm going to have a chance to talk about this stuff in my response, not knowing the rules of evidence, which he wouldn't know. There's nothing about
because we're talking about hearsay here and plain error and an objection that isn't made, which I have to tell you, there are a lot of cases in from our court. We don't even like looking at plain error in a hearsay scenario because it can be fixed by briefing and argument and laying foundation. So, but here, isn't this an excited utterance? How is this court going to find plain error when it seems like classic excited utterance? So
you could determine that it's an excited utterance, but at the end of the day, it's a statement that was allegedly made by the children to mom, and then mom conveys it for the truth of the matter of asserted to the court. And my client doesn't have an opportunity to cross-examine the person that provided that evidence. It's classic hearsay to me. I don't see an exception to it. I'll hold the rest of my time, Your Honor, unless there's other questions.
Any other questions? Nope. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. McGraw. Mr. White, when you're ready, please proceed.
Hello. May it please the court. Appreciate the opportunity to argue today. My name is Spencer White, and my client is the mother, respondent, Ms. Katie Spooner. I want to focus, with the permission of the court, a lot on the standard of review. We didn't actually state it yet, but it's abuse of discretion, and we're looking for clear error and misapplication of the law from the Court of Appeals to apply their ruling. The key case probably is Pachovnik, and in that case, there's some things that really tie into what the Court of Appeals can and can't do and what Mr. McGraw is arguing. So first of all, under Pachovnik, I hope I'm saying that right, the Court of Appeals reviews the record in the light most favorable to the district court's findings, and the Court of Appeals will reverse those findings only if you're left with a definite, firm conviction that a mistake has been made. So throughout this appeal, we're looking for mistakes. And also, the Court of Appeals will not reverse the case because they merely view the evidence differently. And that's basically what Mr. McGraw is asking the court to do, which is not within the purview of the Court of Appeals. And neither does the Court of Appeals reconcile conflicting evidence nor decide issues of witness credibility. And there's part of that is also in Mr. McGraw's arguments. And the witness credibility issue is exclusively the providence of the district court. So I think with that context in mind, I'd like to place on the record the key findings of the court in the order for protection following hearing. That's paragraph 4 on page 1.
Mr. White, can I interrupt you just a moment before you do that?
Yes.
Sort of a broad question here involving a pro se litigant, as Mr. McGraw's client was at the hearing. What role should the judge play when you have the pro se litigant and what on its face is obviously hearsay evidence, both indirectly, I guess, involving the fiance, but more directly involving the children who are the victims, alleged victims at that stage of the petition, to somehow be a bit more proactive in addressing hearsay? And how do we as a reviewing court look at the absence of such obligation, if there is one, or if you believe there is not one? How does that affect our review?
Okay, well, from a practitioner's point, I see a lot of pro se litigants, so I see this a lot. And basically, the judge's discretion is what's in play. And I haven't really had occasion to jump in and say, that's legal advice. But I think the answer to your question is the judge has to walk along a fine line of assisting a pro se party as they deem fit without crossing the line of offering legal advice. So in my brief, I also talked about leeway, which kind of ties into it. The courts have a lot of deference there, but they can't give legal advice. So if that answers your question, it's walking the fine line between reasonable assistance and not legal advice.
Thank you.
I want to defer to Judge Sleater if he wants to follow up, but here's my question for you, Mr. White. So I think there's some case law that supports what you just said, that a judge has to walk a line between assisting and advocacy, you know, cannot be an advocate for a pro se client. Mm-hmm. But there's also some case law that suggests that a pro se client is still held to the same standards and rules that a represented or a counseled client is.
Absolutely.
How does that come into play here, if you would? And I really would love to have you focus your attention on this plain error argument about hearsay. Because I'll listen to you, of course, but it seems to me pretty clear, as Mr. McGraw argued, that the district court did admit hearsay statements of these children and relied on them for the findings. So that happened. So now we really do need to address the whether it was properly handled and an abuse of discretion. So go ahead.
Okay, well, I think I see a lot of courts, including this one, walking up to the line I talked about and probably not crossing it. I almost objected to the help about the hearsay, but I decided not to. I was going to provide an objection, an offer of proof that excited utterance rule 8032 was in play. So I heard a couple of objections. The excited utterance rule was applied properly by the court. And then the other one is the rule 401 was a typo in the transcript. Mr. McGraw knows that because right underneath that, I referenced the opinion testimony of a layperson, which is obviously 701. So under 701, then a lot of things come in that are opinion.
I just don't see how mother repeating the statements of the children is opinion testimony, lay opinion testimony. I mean, what case law do you rely on for that argument?
Well, here's where I go on that. Fundamentally, an order for protection petition many, many times frequently contains a parent's statements about what the children thought or felt. So this court ruled that was admissible because it's been admitted already in the petition, and I have not seen case law or order for protection hearings that limited the testimony of any order for protection petitioner at all. But this is the first time I've taken it to the Court of Appeals, and you bring up a lot of question about it. But the court stated in the record that that's in there, it's already admitted, so move on. Whether that's right or wrong, that's what they do.
So are you going to ask this court to conclude that the admission of the children's statements through mother's testimony was an excited utterance?
Yes, that's what the court found, and I agreed with it. So the court.
You're saying that's what the district court found?
The district court referenced excited utterance in the transcript.
All right.
Can I do it? Would it help if I pointed that out?
No. I just was a little confused because of your reliance on Rule 701. I didn't know if that's what you thought your best argument is, and therefore that's what our basis should be for rejecting the first issue raised by appellant, or if you're relying on excited utterance. I'm sorry if I cut you off.
Well, I think the best evidence of all is the FaceTime call where my client actually witnessed by a video phone call. The abusive incident on April 25, that's my best evidence.
Mr. Waite, can I ask you about that incident? As Mr. McGraw points out there, unlike the subsequent incident, I don't believe there was a separate conversation with the child with mother. Am I correct about that? So what she testified to is what she saw, which is undisputed, that he lifted her. Now, would you go ahead.
Behind, he grabbed her. She was obviously scared. She saw that on the video. It's good evidence. It's not hearsay. It's firsthand witness information.
So your point being is her testimony then from what she saw is what supports the district court's finding of fear of harm.
Yeah, and that's not hearsay. That's based on actual participation, visible information during the actual incident. And whether it's standing next to the child or watching a FaceTime video, it's all the same. It's absolute evidence in support of the district court's ruling. And the district court ruled that the petitioner is credible, which is another thing that, as I understand the case law, the Court of Appeals will not deal with, cannot change. And the other thing is, in Pachovnik, the totality of the circumstances, including a history of past abusive behavior, can be inferred. And the January 24th incident is one such opportunity for the district court to infer that. It's not domestic abuse against the child. It's not domestic abuse against mother. It's a non-party, the fiance, that I don't know if the court inferred from that, but certainly they could do so. And that's not reversible by the Court of Appeals.
What basis was that admissible? Is that the... I mean, are you referring to the text messages, or is that the phone call, or is that what?
No, that came from Ms. Spooner's petition for the order for protection, and it's about page 23. This is what it looks like. It's a paragraph that was mostly read verbatim onto the record by Ms. Spooner in the transcript on page 31, beginning with line 19. And the reason she read it on the record, which is unusual, is because the court copy of that page was illegible. My client went to the court, got a legible copy, and then we used that to support the record because the one we got in the mail was not readable. So under the court's discretion, they said the petition is admitted because it's already in the record. This is a part of that, so therefore it comes in under that particular concept. I did not argue any other authority for that admissibility.
Hey, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So the bottom line is Mr. Warden's a pro se party. He came to the hearing and offered no authority, no witnesses, no evidence to support his testimony. He didn't know the rule of law, didn't know the rules of evidence. He's held to the same standard. And now, after losing the hearing and the case, he now comes before the court asking for forgiveness, asking for relief. And I put in my brief a Supreme Court case that talks about that, basically says that his interest in coming back and changing the record is moot because the Supreme Court said you can't do it.
So, counsel, I think you're being a little short-sighted about appellant's argument, because we do have a district court transcript from the district court judge that sustains the hearsay objection he did make. I mean, as has already been discussed, I don't see that in the transcript as of the time that the mother offers the daughter's statements. But there is a preliminary, if you would let me finish, there is a preliminary objection that is sustained by the court. At least that's how I read it. And then the district court does refer to excited utterance, but is doing that as regards that January 2021 incident, which is, again, that's the fiance's statements, not about the children's statements. So, I mean, this is a troubling handling by the district court judge. I mean, it's not clear. Now, if we're on a plain error review, which is what Mr. McGraw says we're on, then we look at things fairly broadly. And perhaps one of the things we should think about, this court should think about, is whether any error was harmless in light of the text messages, which Mr. McGraw has not challenged on appeal and are in this record.
Yes, that's why we're in today's hearing, appealing the case. So the bottom line, I don't see any abuse of discretion or clear error or misapplication of the law. There's evidence, clear evidence, direct evidence to support the issuance of the order for protection. And we're asking the court to affirm the district court's issuance of the OFP. I reserve the rest of my time.
Just so you know, Mr. White, you can't reserve time. So if there's anything else you want us to, you want to add now, go ahead.
Okay. I think the other key fact is that we have text messages from Mr. Warden and from his fiance that affirm that the children were scared. Mr. Warden apologized for scaring the children, and that's admissible under evidence against party interest. So I don't see that as an error of having that admitted. And that's also clear evidence of the infliction of imminent fear of physical or domestic abuse. Thank you. Appreciate the court.
Thank you, Mr. White. And Mr. McGraw, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
So I appreciate Judge Bradfold pointing this out, that the excited utterance, which I was challenged on in the first part of my argument, as it related to the July 5 incident, the record shows that the court didn't analyze at all the July 5 testimony through the hearsay exception of excited utterance. There wasn't an analysis done at all on that issue. In fact, the court only analyzed it on the July 24 incident, which the court then didn't make findings as it relates to domestic violence on January 24. So there's clearly a problem with the way the court analyzed the hearsay evidence that the court allowed in this case. And I generally want the court just to understand a couple items. Number one, my client was a pro se litigant, and he did the best that he could to voice objection. And he did at various parts of the transcript. And does it always fit at its proper place? It doesn't. But whenever does it for a pro se litigant? He littered in throughout this transcript, at least on three occasions, when he saw troubling testimony come in, he voiced an objection the best way he knew how. I would ask that you read this transcript in its totality while you're addressing the allegations made on July 5, because I would submit to the court that the July 5 allegations are probably most supportive of the court making a finding. I don't see the April 25 incident. If you look at my client's testimony from that incident, he describes a very different set of circumstances. He was there. He talks about redirecting the child and not harming the child.
So that's what he... just because your time is going quickly, and I don't recall you addressing this yet. Any error in the district court in receiving this hearsay testimony, which you know you have focused on so far, is it harmless in light of the text messages and father's testimony that you do not challenge on appeal?
I do not believe it is harmless error. I don't believe it's harmless error because I think the text messages, when you read the text messages, my client doesn't say in there that I committed domestic violence. He doesn't say I struck you. He doesn't describe in any detail any pattern of behavior that was occurring at the residence that would support a finding of the children being in fear of imminent physical harm or bodily injury or assault. He doesn't describe that at all. He says, I'm sorry you were scared. There could be any number of reasons that an individual is, that a child could be scared in an environment. The child could be scared by witnessing conflict between dad and fiance, but that doesn't mean that they feel they're going to be assaulted or they're a fear of imminent assault. That's why counsel has spent so much time talking about 701, is because he knew that he had to go beyond the statements of the children to mom, which were hearsay. And then he had to establish that those statements had the effect that the statute requires it to have. He had to establish that the children were fearful about the conduct that they allegedly had just described to their mother. That's why he spent his time talking about Rule 701 in this opinion testimony, which the court has rightfully rejected and is not seen. It doesn't see the importance of that.
Just to be clear, Mr. McGraw, I'm only speaking for myself. The court hasn't made a ruling on the Rule 701 issue.
I know, and I don't mean to be sloppy with my language, Your Honor. I get excited myself sometimes. But if we just look at that transcript, though, we don't ever see 701 in there. And I've never seen 701 testimony be offered in this type of capacity. And the court didn't make findings that it could be. So it's for all those reasons. I don't believe that this record supports the finding that my client committed domestic violence. I think the court itself had some concerns about whether it did, because the court then makes this finding, which is incredibly detrimental to my client on the family law case, because it anywhere from legal custody, if there's a finding of domestic violence, there's a presumption of non-joint legal custody. But then this court says the dad committed domestic violence, but we're not going to enter a no contact order or otherwise limit his ability to see the children. He walked out of that hearing on July 15. He could have picked his children up that afternoon. Yet this court said that those children were in harm's way in his care. That doesn't fit. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much for your arguments. And this case is now submitted, and we will be issuing our decision within the statutory time period.